Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch Daily News. Jill, sexual assault in the Alaska National Guard. This story, allegations that Guard members sexually assaulted other fellow troops and it was covered up by higher-ups, has been all over Alaska for months. We now have a high-level investigation, although the investigation hasn't been made fully public. It's been talked about. Where are we? What is the citizen to think here?
Well, I think that the complaints continue to fester. There's a sense that things remain unresolved, even with these higher investigations. There's a couple of them that have been underway. One is with an outside entity called the Office of Complex Investigations. That was made at the request of the governor. Those results are still pending. The one that came in more recently was from the Office of the Inspector General, the Army Inspector General, and then a supervisory level of the Inspector General through the Department of Defense. That extra level of attention was required because senior officers were involved in the inquiry. This is something that U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski said into motion last year on, you know, in response to the same complaints that we've heard for some time, that sexual assault victims are not adequately being responded to, that the alleged perpetrators are not adequately being held accountable, that for some reason these cases aren't being referred to civilian law enforcement, which is the appropriate jurisdiction, since the National Guard doesn't have the authority to hold criminally accountable members of its ranks for these types of crimes, although it does have the authority to take administrative action. So the long story short is this Inspector General report has been completed. It has been circulated. We have not yet seen that report, nor to my understanding has Senator Murkowski, but she has received a letter, a one-page letter, kind of debriefing her on the findings. And those findings essentially are, we didn't find any wrongdoing. We didn't find any cover-up. We didn't find any sense among the culture within the Guard that people feel uncomfortable about the topic of sexual assault or about the prospect of reporting sexual assaults. So that's a report by somebody who did an audit. What they did to actually embark on that audit, whether they put the people on the ground here or whether information was just handed over to them, you know, via email and in telephone calls, is unclear. The Inspector General declined to elaborate on the scope and the procedure of their inquiry. So I don't know, in terms of public satisfaction or feeling like this has come to some resolution.
This certainly doesn't satisfy the alleged victims.
It doesn't, or that this is an outcome that we can trust. I don't know that we're there yet. I know that there is a high public outcry to better understand these allegations. I know that the National Guard has conveyed to us, and I believes that it is doing its due diligence, that it's taking action where it is able, that it has executed administrative action as recently as February against some members in the recruiting and retention division who were involved in anything from, I believe, sexual assaults to inappropriate sexual relationships that were against policy.
Now, this has a political dimension, especially involving Governor Parnell, who's running for re-election.
It does.
It seems to me a spokesman for Governor Parnell, the governor wouldn't do this himself, is going to come forward and say, see, the process vindicates the governor, and he was on top of this.
I mean, I think that's foreseeable. You know, we'll see what happens with the results of this other investigation that's coming out. But again, these are like investigators investigating the investigators, and how much transparency of the nature of those investigations the public will be able to have to actually say, here's a situation that wasn't handled correctly, you know, from just the basic reporting process to maybe all the way up. You know, I don't know how we get there.
There's still at least one whistleblower who's saying, no, they didn't get the story, right?
That's correct. And they're the whistleblowers, both who are within the Guard now and who are former members of the Guard, are saying, look, the timelines don't add up. We're aware of these other cases that predate the timeline that the Inspector General supposedly looked at. You know, this is just part of the ongoing cover-up of this, you know, inexcusable culture within the Guard that is allowing these wrongdoers to kind of take cover and not appropriately minister to the victims. You know, as I've mentioned, how and when we get to some kind of resolution where you can say definitively, yes, these situations were not handled correctly, or yes, they were, I don't know, because they, you know, investigations have an element of secrecy to them. They need to, so that they can be conducted appropriately. And victims have a right to their privacy as well.
And this is not a public trial, that's for sure.
No, it's not. And we do know that cases have been referred to the Anchorage Police Department for prosecution, but my understanding is that to date, none of those have been prosecuted for one reason or another. Maybe they were bad cases, maybe there wasn't enough evidence. Maybe
they may have also been old.
They may have been old, maybe it didn't rise to the level. I mean, we just don't know yet.
Okay. Paul, South Central Alaska has been draped in smoke from forest fires. What is the update on the fires, and are we finally going to get them to go away?
I hope so. Hooray for rain, huh? There's two major fires. One at Tionic, it's about 1,900 acres. That's, I think as of yesterday, that was fully contained. Not put out, but contained. There's still crews there fighting hot spots and whatnot. They got a 20-man crew trying to keep that knocked down. And the largest fire is a Funny River fire on the Kenai Peninsula. I think that's the one where we probably got most of the smoke and ash from in Anchorage over the last few weeks. That's 193,000 acres. A lot of it in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, Moose Refuge. And I think it's 46, 47% contained as of 3 or 4 hours ago. And so it's the rain is helping them, I think. Higher humidity is helping them. There have been evacuations. There are no evacuations in play now. They're starting to open up facilities down there again. Skelak Lake Campground, I think, is open, and the boat ramp and that sort of thing. So, and the smoke is clearing up. Up here, it's been wind has driven it the other way. The rain's knocked it down a little bit. So it's not over by a long shot, but at least it's about half contained, and there's maybe more
and
rain.
And what about the implications that the fires, or at least one of the fires, may have been man-made?
I'm not sure about this, the Tionic fire, but the Funny River fire, they initially said it was someone had walked away from a campfire, abandoned campfire. Now they're saying it's man-made, but they won't say how.
Well, didn't they say, like, not a campfire, but
not
still man-made?
Not a campfire, but it's man-made. They won't say what sparked it, they won't say. But they're asking the public in certain areas down
there. And that certainly leaves a lot of candidates for how the fire could have started. Somebody
exactly.
Clearing brush, for example.
Clearing brush, fireworks, who knows? You know, it could be anything.
Okay. Tim, you had something here?
Michael, I just wanted to add that the fire on the west side, the Tionic fire, came uncomfortably close to the Chugach power plant at one point a mile or two, and also the Beluga gas field, which supplies the power plant.
Right.
And that power plant is a major source of electricity for us. So that was a major concern for Chugach Electric and for ConocoPhillips, which operates the gas field. They were very aggressive in cutting clear cuts and putting retardant down to prevent that. There was one time when the wind was driving the fire pretty fast in that direction.
And do you know if that plant had to cut back or cut down or was closed down, what that would mean for Anchorage specifically?
Well, we now have another major power plant here, the South Central Power Plant, which would have presumably picked up a lot of the slack. But still, that's Beluga is a major source of our power down here and for the whole rail belt, really.
Yep.
So.
Okay.
Tim, the SARB board meets and sets the value of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Remind us, what is the SARB, and what did they say, and why does this matter?
Boy, we love that name, don't we?
Yeah.
SARB stands for State Assessment Review Board, and you say why it's important. It's very important to municipalities along the pipeline route, particularly Valdez, whose property taxes are influenced or depend on this. The state annually, the State Department of Revenue annually sets the value. There's always a big fight. It's a ritual every year. The industry comes in and claims the value is low. The pipeline owners, and therefore their tax bill is low. The municipalities came in and always claim it's high. The state comes in the middle. The SARB board, which is supposed to make a ruling on this, is always somewhere usually above the state. This year, originally the claims were from the owners, the oil producers. The pipeline was worth $2.7 billion. I'm sorry, the municipalities claimed it was worth $13.7 billion. The Department of Revenue came down in the middle, $5.7 billion. The SARB board, after listening to a week of testimony and complicated jargon of days after day of hearing, came down to $10.2 billion, I think. So they were sided more on the side of the municipalities.
And now are we in for another round of litigation here?
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be litigated again. This is like clockwork. Every year that we go through this exercise, the SAR board makes its conclusions, it goes to court. And now we've got 3 or 4 years of these things backed up in Superior Court. We have one Supreme Court decision this spring for 2006, and I think there's a couple of years still before the Supreme Court. So it kind of goes on, and someday it'll all get resolved.
And do the companies have to pay with interest when these are finally resolved?
When it's finally resolved, the companies will have to pay. If they owe more, which in case they probably will, they do pay with interest. The big questions for the municipalities are, should they escrow the money or can they spend? See, the way it works is the companies, the municipalities send the tax bills to the companies for their property taxes. The state controls the assessment. The municipalities don't. That's what this fight is all about. On June 1, the municipalities send their tax bills to the companies, pipeline owners, and, you know, based on the assessment value, the companies pay. And if there's a difference years down the road, the companies will have to make up the difference plus interest, or it could go the other way if the Supreme Court decides it's lower.
This goes back to when the pipeline was built and the communities were not allowed to individually tax them because of the kind of rates that they might think. That's we discussed a little bit before. Confiscatory was the term, I believe, that was talked about.
Yeah, they wanted the state to do the assessment or to have some major role in it because they were concerned about the municipalities, with 90% of their revenue and tax base depended on the pipeline or related oil facilities. It's a complicated issue, and it wasn't until the last 10 years that the municipalities really got into this game. For many years, the state Department of Revenue just got together and kind of worked it out. And then about 10 years ago, the municipalities woke up and said, hey, we better be involved in this. So they were. And then in the last 2 or 3 years, it's gotten extremely divisive. Very political this year because the governor was criticized for making a appointment to the board, actually two appointments, one which withdrew, which were people with industry connections. And the municipalities objected heavily to that, arguing these people would lean more toward the industry's view of the pipeline value.
One of the things the governor emphasized, and he emphasized it in emails or staff did to me, was that the governor wanted an outcome that was fair. Now, I don't know what he's thinking today, because what the SAR board said is quite a bit different than what his administration said in the value.
Yeah, the SAR board really sided with the municipalities on two or three of their key arguments they were making as to how the depreciation schedule and the end of the life of the pipeline. And it was radically different than what the companies had proposed and what the state had proposed.
Okay, Paul, Jim Minnery modifies his views on gays and gay marriage. This was front page news, given the conservative activists' opposition in the past and recently to gays and gay marriage. What did he say, and what are the consequences?
He's urging evangelicals to soften their language, their thoughts, their actions when it comes to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. He says he marginalized that community in the run-up to Prop 5, which would have given equal rights, outlaw discrimination based on sexual proclivities. In doing so, he came up with this animated commercial, which showed a guy in a pink dress, a hairy guy, trying to get a job at a daycare. I mean, it was...
I believe the term is over the top.
It was, yeah. I think over the top is right where it's at. I think what we're really seeing here is a political reality. The courts across the country, when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, it opened the door for states across the country to knock down their same-sex marriage laws too, and they've been doing that one by one across the nation. In Alaska, there's a case pending. It'll probably be another year or so before it gets where it needs to be. But the courts up here have already started chipping away at the 1998, the constitutional amendment where we said marriage is a man and a woman. They've done it in property tax exemptions. They did it in state benefits. So the handwriting's on the wall. And he says he's not taking anything back. It looks to me like somebody woke up one day and realized, I'm a step behind the times here. And these things are going to change whether we like it or not. least that we could do is try to be human about it and then soften the soften our language and our attitude.
Thank you, Paul.
More
Tim.
More Christian, I think.
Changes ahead for Alaska's workers' compensation with the passage of House Bill 316. What can we expect in the future for workers' comp?
Michael, what this does is it, well, by background, in under Alaska law, employers have to pay, have to provide workers' comp. They have to help, you know, insulate the workers from the effects of injuries on the jobs. The cost of workers' comp has been going up pretty dramatically in recent years, and we have the highest workers' comp insurance rates in the nation, which is a burden for employers up here. So people have looked at this for some time. The State Workers' Comp Board and the state have looked at this problem and feel that a change in the way the payment is calculated, payment to providers is calculated, was merited. And the old system, or the system up until the time the governor will sign the new bill, based the payment to medical providers based on the 90th percentile of the charge for that particular procedure, which had the effect of meaning that the most costly provider set the rate for everybody. And that was, that people felt was one of the things that was really driving up the workers' comp insurance costs. The state came in, proposed the workers' comp board came in and proposed an alternate method where they would do what a lot of other states would do, which is use the Medicare and Medicaid payment rates, you know, adjusted for Alaska, but with an added differential to adjust for other contingencies and factors. For, you know, so, like 30 different states use this method now. And now how that, all that's going to work out is yet to be determined, because a lot of people are asked the question, well, what exactly is this differential and how are you going to use it? So that's, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Do you
out.
Know how many claims are filed annually, or typically are filed annually?
I don't, Michael, but it's thousands of claims are filed. Now, a lot of these are very minor injuries, back strains and things like that, but some of them are quite serious. But workers' comp has become a very, very expensive burden on the state, and this is an effort to try to reduce those costs.
Okay. Jill, Verizon, the telecom giant, comes to Alaska, will shake up telecommunications. What have you learned about Verizon's interest in Alaska?
So Verizon a year ago began data service for customers up here. No voice service, but data only. And they have recently announced that beginning in the fall, they will also bring voice online. So consumers up here can now be Verizon customers in the major metropolitan areas, Matsu, Juneau, Fairbanks, kind of the road system as we understand it, and get voice and data, and presumably travel, you know, in the lower 48 with those phones. GCI and ACS had last year, or recently, yeah, within the last year, formed the Alaska Wireless Network, which allowed them to share infrastructure. And in part, this was a move anticipating Verizon's entry into the market so that they would be able to kind of have the same corridors available to their customer base, but without having to separately build out infrastructure to provide those towers. So I think, you know, for consumers, there will be new retail stores, there will be new plans to compare, and we'll see what happens. I know that there are some people that are very, very happy to have Verizon up here.
Applying to the Alaska-based corporations, because AT&T is here.
AT&T is here.
There are others.
GCI is here. You have ACS, and then you've got some smaller telecoms. The interesting thing is kind of what is the long-term get for Verizon. They said in an interview with us earlier this week, last week, that this was a response to existing customers of theirs who complained about the high roaming costs, whether they were business travelers up here or they were tourists who were coming in, and that at some point it was more cost effective for them to be up here with their own infrastructure to provide these services than to be paying someone else to allow their customers to roam. We know that the landscape in Alaska is changing with the telecom industry, particularly with broadband and high-speed data transmission. We have GCI that's building out northwest, western coastline of Alaska, providing that service where previously it hasn't existed. And then we have this concept of the Arctic fiber cable, which is supposed to be this subsea international cable connecting Asia to the London markets, and with some spurs that will allow Alaska's coasts to tap into that and provide high-speed, affordable data, internet, voice to those communities. And with a potentially a conduit coming down from Prudhoe Bay to Fairbanks to Anchorage to the lower 48, that provides another element of competition that's a longer term kind of business plan, but one that Verizon has acknowledged it's contemplating, it's looking into, and it's thinking about. And that would certainly be another dimension of competition for GCI.
One thing I find myself wondering about, we're often told Alaska has, 800,000 people, less than 1 million people. We're smaller than many cities.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there must be a belief at Verizon that they can make an effect, this population of one, pretty good-sized city in the country, make money.
I said, we're remote. We have a low population base. What's in it for you? And the response that I got from them was that this was a response to their customer base that was like tired of these high roaming charges. Now I have heard through other entities that there was some kind of FCC mandate that required Verizon to be up here in some capacity. Exactly what that was, I don't know. And then certainly the competitors are saying, look, Verizon's really only catering to the tourist corridor, to the road corridor. We'll see if they're really in it to serve Alaskans, as an entire state, or just to kind of make this limited entry.
Okay, come back again and tell us more.
Yeah.
Tim, six Native regional corporations pledged to vote the Vote No campaign, opposing the voter-sponsored referendum that would repeal Senate Bill 21. What are they up to?
Michael, I went to this announcement this week, and six of the corporations, four of them have substantial interest in the oil field business, so you can understand why they feel their business is affected. Two of the corporations, Bering Straits and Siri, do not have substantial oil field interests, so they argue that they have an interest in, they think this is going to hurt the general economy, and they feel it's not in the state's interest. The other corporations point to the fact that the oil, their oil service business is important to them and employs shareholders, and they see the repeal of SB 21 as a threat. Now, I was quite struck by the fact that the critics, the people who support the repeal, were quick to point out that this is only six of the 12 regional corporations, and what about the other ones? And I don't think at this point, this group that has organized this, pretty much led by Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, feels that there will be others joining their coalition. And I don't think you could probably say that the others, it doesn't mean that they're for the repeal of SB 21. It's just, they're just not taking a position on this. The only exception to that, I think, might be Sea Alaska Corporation, which is where Byron Malotte is from. Byron is former CEO of Sea Alaska. I think he's still a board member there. Byron's running for governor, and he has endorsed the repeal. So I think this coalition that was formed is a bit of an embarrassment, for Byron. So I think Sea Alaska may be trying to help out Byron.
And it would presumably make it a bit harder for him to go to the executives and leaders of those corporations and ask for money.
I would think so, yeah. They seem to be arguing that they're going to be quite active. And that's why I don't see the others that who are not now part of this coalition actively campaigning for the repeal either. I don't see what's in it for them. It's not as if the repeal is going to bring in a lot of new money, because we know that, the revenue effect are really about the same between the two.
So, okay, let's get over to Paul Jenkins. Paul, Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew says his department is understaffed. What does the chief mean by understaffed, and what action does he take to remedy the situation?
Well, they've got 23 cadets now in an academy. They've got 16 cadets from the last academy out in field training. If you add that with the 327 sworn police officers he has now, you've got 366. You're still short of the 372 that he's budgeted for, or the 375 that the police executive research forum recommended a city this size have. And what that does is it tends to make this department more reactive than proactive. If officers are going from call to call rather than having free time to respond to their own things, then you've got a reactive department. They're depending on overtime to make up the slack. That's hard on officers to work those kind of hours. The union will tell you that it's pay and benefits is why we have the attrition here and why people leave and go elsewhere. They lost three senior officers recently, I suppose, to other departments. There is a problem with the increased numbers of people leaving in the last year or so, because there was a concessions made in the last contract that if officers retired before January 1st of this year, they would get those concessions back, and they would be added into the retirement package. And a lot of officers apparently took them up on that, so they knocked the hole in the department. They're going to have another academy in the fall, and we'll see if we can plug the holes. The police department, people come, people go. And it might be that we need somebody from outside to take a look at this thing and try to figure out what the problem really is.
Thank you. Tim, we have only about a minute and a half here, but veteran reporter Bob Tkach died a couple of days ago in Juneau. You knew him quite well. Tell us about Bob. Remind us about Bob.
Well, Bob was not well known outside of Juneau, but he was extremely well known in the Capitol building as one of the most longest serving and also one of the most aggressive and interesting reporters around. Going to a press conference where Bob was present was memorable. He was well known for very aggressive questions, very penetrating, would not let politicians off the hook. If they sensed he was getting their own runaround, Bob could be quite combative. So he was well known. A lot of politicians didn't particularly like Bob, but they all respected him.
What did he specialize in?
Well, Bob had besides just general reporting, he worked for a long time with the publication that my brother and I produced, Legislative Digest. But his particular specialty was fisheries reporting. He had his own newsletter called Laws of the Sea. And he also traveled, he was very active in covering the general fishery and seafood industry, would travel annually to Asia to the seafood expositions, big seafood conferences there.
And I know he was there as long as I went to Juneau on a regular basis to see the legislature in action. Thank you very much for joining us. Next week, we'll be taking the week off as the annual campaign will be in progress. We'll miss you, but we'll be back here in 2 weeks for Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.